I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our civil rights attorney, Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, blogger and political science professor Lester Spence, and NPR's political editor, Ken Rudin. Of course, we heard from Jimmy earlier in the program. There's only so much we can take. So, gentlemen, we'll have to just sort of carry on without him today. So let's jump right in. This week, embattled New York governor went on the offensive to dispel these unsubstantiated rumors of personal misconduct, including infidelity, apparently beyond that to which he had already confessed rather early in his term. Now, allegedly, these allegations are supposed to be discussed in an upcoming article by the New York Times, but the Times is not confirming or denying any of this. So the governor Ken, I'm very interested in your perspective on how he's handled this. He had a press conference on Tuesday. Then last night he went on Larry King Live and talked about this. I'll play a short clip. Here it is.
The human decency, if not journalistic ethics, I think would compel an organization when they see a person being slandered for over 2 weeks now. I've been waiting for 3 weeks for this article to come out to clear the air and at least say the charges that are being made are not in the perimeters of our investigation.
The New York Times should print something tomorrow.
I wish they would, so I could be out of my misery, because the reality is that these charges have been unsubstantiated. They are speculations. And, Larry, it's like a Kafkaesque scenario.
Ken, you blogged about this. The whole thing is puzzling to me.
It is puzzling, and it's upsetting. First of all, my initial reaction was you should never dignify rumors, because all they are rumors. But David Paterson, first of all, has been in big trouble. His numbers are terrible in his bid for a full term in 2010. And so he decided to, well, I guess, dignify the rumors by holding a press conference. The point is, when you have the New York Daily News and the New York Post and every blogger in the world constantly on their front pages talking about either drug use or sexual peccadilloes, or I think one paper said he was responsible for kidnapping the Lindbergh baby. I mean, the rumors are just so insane. And you think that, please just stay out of it, ignore it. But it's taking a tremendous toll on his person, on his popularity, as low as it is, and I think he had to address it.
You do think he had to address it, because normally these brushback pitches go on in private. You know, you've got your surrogates calling the paper. Normally the brushback pitch doesn't happen in public. And so do you think that is this a reflection of the new media age in which, you know, stories can be discussed even before they are printed or stories? Or do you think this is more about him?
Well, it's both. I think that the way the media have covered it, I think, is very disappointing. The fact that the tabloids in New York have had rumors on the front pages for days, which is very, very upsetting. But again, it takes a toll on you. And if you have any chance of holding on to your job, as David Paterson apparently wants to do, I guess he had to address it.
Lester, what do you think?
I don't know if... So to the extent that maybe he does have to address this, I think there's a way to spin his response to deal with the signal problem that New York State has, which is that it's a failed state. You've got significant – they don't know how to deal with this budget deficit. You've got significant numbers of politicians that have been accused basically of corruption, and it's not like, you know, stuff that's made up. I think – To the extent that you want to give a narrative here, what you want to say is like, listen, New York State is failing. We want to be able to put kids back in school. We want to be able to deal with the issues that New Yorkers face. This stuff isn't important. You know, because if you listen to the tape, what he's talking about is me. You know, oh, this is hurting me. Like, no, it's not about you. It's about the state.
Do you think he opened the door, though, by confessing infidelity so early in his term, like within a week or two after he was not elected to this position initially. He took it because he was lieutenant governor, and then Eliot Spitzer resigned because of what turned out to be true allegations that he had consorted with a prostitute. And after having taken such a hard line sort of legally on this question, it was politically untenable for him to stay. On the other hand, the argument is he had to out himself, as it were, because if he didn't, someone else would. So do you think he opened the door? Or do you think
I think he had to out himself. I think it was an excellent idea just to get all that stuff out there and to move to governance. It's just that it didn't stick.
Ruben, what do you think?
I think that I have trouble with the way that David Paterson has conducted himself in his marriage, but I don't have any trouble with the way he's conducted himself in public with regard to these scandals. I think that was a good move. It was probably the only move he could make, both in coming out at the very beginning of his term and admitting past infidelities, and most recently sort of confronting the rumors out in public. But what I'm much more concerned about, and the failing grade I'm going to give is not to David Paterson, but to the New York Times. I don't fault the tabloids for, as Ken said, putting rumors on the front page. I fault somebody at the New York Times leaked this story, okay? These stories exist all the time at newspapers. There are people at newspapers know stories that are not yet ready for print, and they keep them to themselves. Somebody leaked this story within the New York Times, either because they don't like Paterson or they do like Andrew Cuomo, who is in line to benefit from all of this, or whatever, for whatever reason, or to gin up initially a kind of electronic frenzy for the finished product so it, when it does come out, it's a big splash.
Wait, but you have to interview people. I mean, the fact of interviewing people is not leaking, per se. I mean, the fact is
the interviewing, Michelle, but somebody put together this story, and then it started to leak out the New York Times was about to publish. When a story leaks out that a newspaper is about to publish, it's because somebody at the newspaper leaked the story out and started talking.
I don't know if I buy that. The reporting process itself can be sort of semi. I don't know. I take your point. Arsalan, you want to weigh in briefly before we move on?
Sure. I mean, first of all, being from Chicago, I don't think I'm anyone to speak about the internal failings of state politics here. I do think the one point that has been slightly overlooked is the fact that I think that this might be a little bit of blowback. From the fact that this is that he was a lieutenant governor from Eliot Spitzer's gubernatorial regime, and so. I think that, that's one aspect that has to be looked at as well.
We don't even know if the Times has this story. I mean, there's a rumor, but we, how can we blame the Times for leaking it? We don't even know if the story exists.
Wow.
Well, and I guess I'm sort of thinking, is it a thing where the reporting process itself, then they're trying to force their hand? I mean, I've had experience with this on election night where people, when I was at ABC, when I was reporting on election night, where people kind of hacked into our instant messaging system and started haranguing us to call states that we hadn't called yet. So this is kind of what this reminds me of. It'll be very interesting to see whether this is a media story or a political story, or just that this is the new media age where even reporting can't be done, privately, as it were. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop. We're visiting with Arsalan Iftikhar, Ruben Navarrete, Ken Rudin, and Professor Lester Spence. The other big story here in Washington, of course, along with the blizzard, is that back-to-back storms, just to defend why we're all exhausted, is that the nation's capital was preparing for the blizzard. First Lady Michelle Obama unveiled this national initiative intending to address childhood obesity. I'll just play a short clip for people who may not have heard it. Here it is.
The current generation is actually on track to having a shorter lifespan than their parents. So instead of just talking about this problem and worrying and wringing our hands, it's time for us to get going and do something about this. So let's move. Let's get this done. Let's move to get families and communities together to make healthy decisions for their kids.
Ruben, I'm interested in, as a father and as a person who covers policy, do you think that this is a worthwhile subject for the government? I'm interested in how you react to this.
Yeah. No, the answer is no. I don't think this is a worthwhile subject for the government. I think it's a good cause, but it's not a cause taken up by government. It should be taken up by parents and homes. My wife runs roughshod over the kids, over me, in terms of what I give the kids, in terms of buying a cereal and checking the box to see what the sugar content is on the cereal, keeping your kids away from soft drinks and all those other things. Here's my thing. About 7 years ago, I was in an argument with a Republican, and that is the Secretary of Agriculture in Texas at the time, Susan Combs, wanted to come up with this initiative to do away with soft drinks in public schools. And my argument was, it's not the role of government to protect kids from soda. It's the role of parents. And so now I'm stuck, because if I fought that battle with a Republican, now I've got to turn around and fight it with Michelle Obama. I've got to be consistent. The same exact rule applies. I don't think this is the role of government. This is about better parenting, not about better laws or better government.
Well, who decided that the sugar and fat content would be on the labels?
Well, yeah, once it's put up there, why put it on the label, right? Put it on the label to let me as a customer and as a parent know. But to then swoop in and say, by the way, we don't even trust you to read the label. The retort to what I'm saying, I guess, is, well, what about those parents who don't take it upon themselves to do this? Well, this is not the answer to that. You don't absolve parents of their responsibilities by coming in and saying that the parents are going to be, that government's going to be the nanny that comes in and tells you not to give your kids soda. And again, to be consistent, if I had a beef with the Republican because I thought that Republicans were trying to creep into our lives, I've got to be consistent now and criticize the Democrat when they do the same thing.
Lester, what do you think?
First, it's important to recognize that it's not parents on one hand and government on the other. Parents are government, right? Second is that there are these structural dynamics that have an effect on what type of, on the range of choices that parents routinely make. So I'm a Detroit guy. You look in the city of Detroit or like the north side of St. Louis, you find almost no grocery stores, right? So Detroit has like a million people. It's big enough to cover Boston, San Francisco, and Manhattan and have room left over, and there are no major grocery stores, right? That doesn't have anything to do with parents' choices. There's something structural going on that's affecting that. To the extent that that the First Lady's program deals with that, I think it'd be very helpful.
Ken, what do you think?
Look, parents tell you, the kids, look, you buckle your seatbelt. They tell you not to smoke, but the kids don't always listen. I think having the government saying, look, there are some things that need to be done to keep you living longer. Look at Bill Clinton. I mean, he's in the hospital for the second time in 5 years for obviously not eating well, shall we say. He once jogged a bunch of reporters over to McDonald's when he was president. So I think, look, it's not a question of government control or government intervention. I think it's smart thinking, and I think Michelle Obama should be commended for it.
Well, speaking of food and what we eat, I don't know if you guys watched the Super Bowl. If you didn't, you were like the three people who did it, the four people who did it. There were like 100 million.
It was Sunday,
people.
Right?
Yeah, right, exactly. It was like 106 million people watched it. And of course, the ads are always the thing that get people's attention. It's interesting to me how many of them are for beer and how many of them are for junk food. But having said all that, did anybody have a favorite ad? Arslan, did you have a favorite?
Yeah, I love the Hyundai ad with Brett Favre, the futuristic 2020 MVP, that he'll still be playing well into his 50s. I thought that was great.
Ken, what about you? Are you trying to tell us you didn't watch it? You know you watched it.
Of course
on.
I watched it, and I loved it, and I loved that the Giants won, right? Anyway, my favorite commercial.
Right, he did.
Yeah,
you owe me money.
The Snickers commercial when Betty White and Abe Vigoda, first of all, I thought Abe Vigoda was dead, but the fact that Betty White and Abe Vigoda were tackled, or it looked like they were tackled, was hysterically funny.
That was funny. Lester, what about you? You have a favorite?
Yeah, that ad was, I liked the Leno Letterman ad with Oprah in it. I thought that was funny. But no, you're right, that Betty White, Abe Vigoda ad, I thought myself saying, fish! Oh my God, I thought fish was dead.
You know, it's funny, there was so much controversy over the Tim Tebow, the ad featuring Tim Tebow and his mom, but at the end of the day, I don't know that it even registered. But one ad that's getting some attention on the, in the blogosphere was this ad for Doritos that, let me just play it. It's about a guy shows up for a date with a mom who's obviously a single mom, and her little boy is there, and here it is. Let me just play it for you. Here it is.
Hi.
Hello.
Aw, thank you. Have a seat. Kyle, Jalen. Jalen, Kyle.
Jalen, you play nice.
I'll be right back.
What's going on, little man? I see you got your game skills down pack. You might have your hands full once. I'll pick up the controller, little man.
Put it back. Keep your hands on my mama. Keep your hands on my Doritos.
Jalen, are you playing nice?
Now what you can, Lester's cracking up here. What you can see is that when mom walks away, the date brings flowers for mom, who's quite cute. But when she walks away, the date is checking mom's butt out. Okay, and little boy does not appreciate this and response. And Lester, what did you? I mean, a lot of people are thinking, well, wait, hold on here. What's first of all, everybody's African American in this. Yeah. That's thing one. And thing two is what's with having a little boy slap a grown man, and what's that all about? And so a lot of people are talking about this. So Lester, what do you think?
Yeah, I thought it was hilarious. But the thing is that a lot of, you know, black family images are intensely political. There's no way around it. So as hilarious as it was, the first thing I was thinking with my, you know, political scientist, public intellectual hat on is like, wow, the politics here aren't right. You know, what type of message does this send about black families, about how they're constructed?
Yeah, Arsene, what did you think? You sent it to me. I was wondering, what did you think? You sent me all the ads because you know, you're a student of the Super Bowl ads. We had a lengthy discussion about the ads. Arsene, what did you think?
You know, like Lester, I thought it was fun. I mean, I thought the kid was adorable in the commercial. I think that one of the few things that did jump out, I think you mentioned it to me, you know, was that the gentleman in the commercial, you know, had braids, which, you know, obviously elicited a very blue-collar background. You know, I wonder, you know, would it have had the same effect if the guy had, you know, shown up for the date in a suit and stuff? I think holistically speaking, I thought it was a funny ad. I thought the kid was adorable, and I love Doritos.
Oh, okay. And Ruben, what about you? What do you think?
Good ad, harmless ad, fun ad. I wasn't as troubled as some people were by the fact that a child, you know, hit an adult. But I thought it was, I think it was good. It was clever. And, you know, we're at a place now where this arrangement, as Les was talking about, applies to people of all different colors. You have, in the same scenario, you could have a white family, a Latino family, an Asian family, and still have a single mom and somebody coming over to take her on a date. So I didn't see the race thing. I saw it being funny.
Ken, what about you? What do you think?
I disagree with everybody. I saw it, well, as the token white here, I saw it as a race thing. I saw it filled with stereotypes, yeah. A single black woman, and violence at home. I didn't smile at the end at all. I was very upset with it.
Well, you're never a token to us, Ken, but I have to tell you I agree with you on that. I think that having a little boy slap a grown man, appalling. You.
Absolutely.
And why does he have to be checking out mom's butt? I think, you know, I don't know. There was just a lot there that I found disturbing. Well, happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Anybody got any good plans they want to share for those who haven't yet made any? Lester, are you?
Black tie affair with my wife and the Q's. We get it in.
Okay. Arsalan, still a newlywed. Any good plans you want to tell us about?
A dozen roses, bouquet of cookies, because we're a bunch of sweet tooths, and dinner anywhere she wants.
All right, Ruben, you got anything?
Yeah, a special dinner planned in advance and a nice movie, and the parents are babysitting.
Awesome. Ken, anything you want to tell
us about? I'm going to tackle Betty White.
Hi, that's hot.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to all of you. Hopefully there's some ideas there for people. Don't say you forgot, because we don't let you know. Lester Spence is a blogger and political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, the founder of themuslimguy.com. Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor. And Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for the San Diego Union-Tribune and CNN.com. Thanks, everybody.
Peace.
Thanks.
Happy Valentine's Day.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Brecton Booker, Monica Evstatieva, Jasmine Garst, Lee Hill, Douglas Hopper, Arjun Hutchins, Emily Oxenschlager, and Jennifer Longmire-Wright. Our intern this semester is Danielle Gerson. Our planning editor is Laurie Grant. Our senior editor is Louise Clemens. Our senior producer is Alicia Montgomery. The program is directed by Rob Sachs. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior producer is Tashima Walker. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.